You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The recent news about health care in this country has been troubling. Although the Affordable Care Act has led to a sharp drop in the number of uninsured people, in some states, insurance companies have been pulling out of the Obamacare exchanges, leaving only a single choice of insurer. And the recent astronomical price increases for EpiPens has served as a reminder of the power the pharmaceutical companies have to control drug prices. We have asked Elizabeth Rosenthal to talk about these recent developments. She wrote the New York Times series Pain Till It Hurts and is now the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. She's also the author of a forthcoming book called An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How to Take It Back. Elizabeth, welcome back to our show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's been more than 2.5 years since the Affordable Care Act took total effect. Do you think that it's delivered on its promises?
Well, it's delivered on some of them, but not all of them. I mean, there's no one fix all for healthcare, I think, is the lesson. It has given people with pre-existing conditions access to insurance, which, even if it did nothing else, would be a huge win for patients. But of course, like any new system, the medical world and the business of medicine has figured out ways to kind of get around some of its well-meaning provisions. So I think, you know, the Affordable Care Act, as I like to say, is a beginning point, not an end point.
What's going wrong? Why are insurers leaving the exchanges?
Well, no one's sure exactly. I mean, there are a lot of theories, and they all have their reasons, but some of it may be that they didn't really have a lot of experience in offering insurance to this kind of population. They've tended to, in the past, to offer insurance to companies, so maybe they're getting more sick patients, which they knew they would, but maybe they haven't planned appropriately and worked out the finances of that. Another thing which I think is very likely in some markets is that they underpriced their products. Look, what people had to go on was price. So they set their prices low and then realized, uh-oh, wait a second, people are using too much health care and we can't afford to deliver at this price, and some of them have decided to pull out. Personally, I'm not kind of alarmed that some are pulling out. Many are staying in, and many will find out how to make this work, but it's a learning curve for them as well as for patients.
Although the decision of one of the biggest insurers, Aetna, to reduce participation in the exchanges has been posited as having political implications, as a form of retaliation.
Yes, I mean, there's certainly the theory floating around that they had hoped to have their merger plans approved and that they decided to pull out because the FTC seems to be impeding those plans. I mean, there's a lot of politics and a lot of finance that goes on in healthcare, and it often determines poor patients what kind of access to insurance and healthcare we get.
Are most of the insurance companies losing money on their Obamacare plans, even if they're making a profit overall?
Well, it's hard to know because they say they are. What does it mean to be losing money, though? You know, part of the problem is that hospital prices and physician prices are very, very high, and the insurers, to some extent, in markets where the medical providers have a lot of control, are stuck with the prices that the providers are giving them. Also, there's a lot of gaming going on in the system. So, you know, we know, for example, that things like colonoscopies are supposed to be free. Screening colonoscopies are supposed to be free for patients. So that means the insurer can't charge a copay. So if they're in a market where they're stuck with a very high-priced colonoscopy, say $10,000, and they do get up that high when you're folding in operating room costs and anesthesia costs, they can be stuck paying some really high prices. So price is a big problem throughout our system, and the Affordable Care Act tries to tackle that indirectly, but we obviously need much more.
Are younger, healthier people not signing up in the numbers that they had hoped?
I think the data is still out on that, and certainly people need to make the connection of, if I don't sign up, I'm going to pay at tax time, but that's pretty far away from sign-up time, so people may not have made that connection, some of the younger, healthier folks. Some people may have decided that the penalty is worth it. I mean, a lot of the plans in the U.S. and many of the Affordable Care Act plans have pretty high deductibles. I think I've heard now the average deductible is up around over $1,000, $1,200 to $1,400. Our survey people here at the Kaiser Family Foundation have been looking at this and look at it carefully each year. Now, someone may have decided, a young person may have decided, look, I'm young, I'm healthy. My insurance is going to cost me a lot. I'll pay the penalty and take the risk.
Is there also a geographical divide? Is the ACA working better in states with larger, more concentrated populations, or in states where the political climate is more favorable to the ACA?
Well, I think health care is ultimately local, and that's really the issue. So there are a lot of factors to go in to whether the ACA is, and I use the term working kind of in quotation marks, or not, because every time I run a large Facebook group of people who are interested in health care costs from across the country, and I'll get some of our members from one state saying the ACA is a big problem for me, my premiums have gone up, the deductible's high, I can't find doctors and network, and then others in other states will say, it saved my life. I have great insurance now, and I really like it. So I think one of the key issues that we'll have to look at going forward is how much are state regulators looking at the ACA plans? Are they saying we need standard benefits? Are they saying these plans have to have this kind of broad insurance network so patients have some choice? I mean, California patients that I hear from are mostly pretty happy with their ACA plans, but California has been much more proactive in saying what's an acceptable insurance plan? What kind of network do we need to have in the plan? I mean, we hear this from a lot of states that, oh, I thought I had insurance, but guess what? The closest orthopedist is 200 miles away. Now, in some states, that would not be considered an acceptable network. And I think one of the things we're going to see going forward is states taking a closer look at the plans on offer and asking, do they meet a bar of meaningful insurance? And that's really important, and it varies a lot state by state.
I'm talking with Elizabeth Rosenthal, who's editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and still a contributor to the New York Times. If insurance companies are pulling out of the exchanges, could the government step in and offer a public option? Isn't Hillary Clinton proposing something along those lines?
Yes, this is the public option, and just for people who don't know what that means, it means the government will step in and offer a health plan of its own. And, of course, the U.S. government has a pretty good health plan for people over 65 already. It's called Medicare. So we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel to do this. Because of dissatisfaction, I think, in large part with some of the ACA offerings, and because, of course, her competitor in the primaries, Bernie Sanders, was proposing a national single-payer plan, Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State and current Democratic candidate, suggested that there should be a public option offering Medicare as a pay-in for people under, I think, over 55. So that's certainly an option, too. And what a public option does, in effect, is it says to the commercial players, and it's partly why they don't like it, you have to be at least as good as Medicare to compete, because otherwise people will buy into Medicare. So, President Obama, before the ACA was passed, had at times favored a public option. A lot of politicians have favored a public option. It's always been not very acceptable to the commercial insurers because it requires a level of competition with Medicare that I think they don't want to see.
And then there's the whole matter of Congress, which has had many votes to eliminate the ACA. They're very unlikely to want to go along with something like a public option.
Yes, that's true, too. I mean, as I said, you know, this is a political discussion. It's a financial discussion. What it's not primarily, and what it should be, is more of a healthcare discussion.
A listener has called in to point out that in New York City, a lot of hospitals have closed, merged, and consolidated in recent years. Hasn't that resulted in cost savings? Why aren't they being passed on to us?
Well, I mean, oddly, New York is one of the more competitive markets still. We do have four or five different hospital systems operating. They have taken a number, each one has taken in a number of smaller hospitals under their wing. But what tends to happen is the cost isn't passed on to consumers. And you know what? I think all the studies show that the result of consolidation at first is cost saving, but in the long term, mostly what it does now is it gives those hospitals much more negotiating clout with insurers to demand higher prices. So we, the patients, don't necessarily get the benefit of that consolidation. And I think that's something that we need to look at very carefully. And that in other parts of the country where the market for healthcare is even more consolidated, the FTC is looking at very carefully, too. If you end up with only one or two hospital systems in an area, they have tremendous power over pricing, and there have been studies showing that prices tend to go up.
If the commercial insurers are pulling out, why would they oppose a public option?
Well, there are still commercial insurers in who want to make this work. I think the ones who are pulling out completely probably don't care that much, but I think there are plenty who are pulling out of certain states and staying in others. And ultimately, you know, we believe in competitive systems and competitive healthcare, so that could work. I don't think if they pull out completely, they obviously lose their vote, but most of them are in at least some states, and I think would like to be able to compete.
Some months back, you wrote a piece for the Times called Sorry We Don't Take Obamacare, which
right.
examined the way in which some companies have tried to improve profits by narrowing their provider networks. Are some people finding their company's networks so narrow that they can't find a doctor in the area? You mentioned in some cases that they have to go pretty far afield. Is it because
yeah.
there aren't doctors in the area, or because there aren't doctors who are covered by the insurance in the area?
Oh, I think it's because the narrow networks, the way insurers and insurance plans can keep their costs down is by contracting with a very small subset of doctors. And that's often unacceptable to patients. And they're often not contracting. Say, for example, I want to make sure I have kids. I want to make sure the good children's hospital or the only children's hospital in my city is in the network. Well, maybe it's not in a very narrow network plan. And I would have to get my pediatric care at a general hospital. Now, that might be okay, but if your kid ended up with a very rare pediatric illness, you might want to know that the specialty hospital was in network. So I think one of the big problems to be addressed will have to be this issue of narrow networks and what constitutes an adequate network. You can have a good narrow network, but patients have to understand in advance that that's what they're dealing with, and it has to have certain essential components. And there wasn't that initial requirement in the ACA. That's not inherent in the ACA. That has to be imposed by other means.
I'm talking about some of the recent problems in healthcare in this country with Elizabeth Rosenthal, who wrote the New York Times series Paying Till It Hurts and has written a lot about these issues for the Times. She is now the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and the author of a forthcoming book called An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How to Take It Back. We have a link to that on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate, an opportunity for people to pre-order your book.
Yeah, I believe it's available for pre-order already. It won't come out until next year.
We'll take a little break and come back with more of this conversation. We're talking with Elizabeth Rosenthal, who is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and a frequent contributor to the New York Times. Recent news stories suggests that premiums will likely rise substantially for the ACA plans next year. Will those increases make the plans less than affordable for many of the people who signed on because they couldn't afford regular health insurance?
Well, you have to remember with the ACA plans, there's still premium support. So the higher the premiums go, the more people will be eligible for subsidies. So people may not feel it that much. And a lot of those rates were set very low to begin with. So I think where people are going to be hurting, ironically, is in the deductible category where, yes, you know, their premiums may have gone up 10%, which is a lot, but that may amount to $5, $10 a month and less after the subsidy. But then they bought that health insurance and they think, okay, I've done the right thing. I've gotten myself insured after years of not having insurance. And then lo and behold, you have a $1,500 or a $3,000 deductible. So then you're paying more. I think that's where people are going to get caught by surprise. So the numbers, when we see these percentage increases, they are alarming, but on the whole, people may not feel them very much because of the subsidies.
I've also been hearing stories about how insurers are becoming more difficult about paying claims as a way, I guess, to improve their bottom lines. And someone I know now is going to have to fight to get her care paid for. She had this experience. She became ill, was hospitalized using in-network providers. The hospital got authorization from the insurance company, but then the insurer canceled the authorization after the fact and denied the claims due to lack of authorization.
Yeah.
Who's making these decisions?
Well, I think that's the problem. There are a lot of games being played between the providers and the insurers, and who's stuck in the middle? The patients. So the business of pre-authorization, you know, of course, inherently it's not a bad idea. We know there's a lot of wasteful stuff that goes on in healthcare, and so insurers started for the really big stuff requiring pre-authorization. But it's become more and more onerous, I think, for the doctors to get, and then it trickles down to even procedures that are clearly necessary that you shouldn't need pre-auth. And then you find out, like the story you're telling me, that pre-authorization was canceled and the patient didn't know about it. Okay, so
and now is stuck with a huge bill with a company that has a 5-star rating.
Right, and that's a big problem now. And you know what I would do? I would try and appeal that under the surprise medical bill law because she had no way of knowing that. But the surprise medical bill law, we'll see how well it works for these kind of situations. It was really intended more to guard people against out-of-network bills. What she's seeing is a different kind of gaming of the system that, you know, it really leaves patients stuck. I heard from another patient who was in the middle of cancer treatment, in the middle of breast cancer treatment, and in the middle, lo and behold, her provider left the network. So what's she supposed to do? Find a different person to do the last three rounds in a different hospital for the last three rounds of her chemotherapy? And that's really the problem with all of these systems is that when they break down, who's stuck? Not the insurer, not the provider, but the patient, and it's our health.
And let's consider another kind of situation. If someone has chest pains, goes to the hospital because he or she suspects he's having a heart attack, it turns out not to be the case, can the insurance company then deny the claim based on the outcome?
Well, they could try. You know, that's the problem. They could try. Now, technically, of course, if you're having an emergency, you go to the nearest emergency room, and that should be covered. And you certainly don't want to tell people when you're having chest pain. I mean, we've spent years telling people if you're having chest pain and you're not sure, you should go to the ER to get checked right away. Don't, like, sit there and download your provider's list of in-network hospitals. So we want people to go quickly and regardless from a medical point of view. Now, after the fact, someone might try and say, it wasn't a heart attack, so deny. Now, I think this is where patients have to get much more empowered in saying, no, I did the right thing. And I wish employers would get behind their employees in fighting these kinds of decisions, because ultimately it's our pocketbooks and our health.
To appeal an insurance company's decision, mm-hmm. you have to file an appeal with the company that denied the claim.
Right.
You get the feeling that it's unlikely they're going to want to reverse their original decision.
Well, I mean, you know, you can always say, I'm going to report this to the state regulators, too, which I was talking with a colleague of mine. That is often a fairly complicated process, but I think we all need to start doing that more. There are insurance regulators in each state, and there are consumer protection bureaus in each state. And I think instead of just writing the check, it's time to start calling them out a little more and reporting things. But there's no good solution right now, and that's why I have all these different missions to accomplish, why I'm here at Kaiser Health News, which is independent health journalism. We're starting to look into some of these things, why I wrote a book, why I was doing all the work at the New York Times, because there isn't a good solution for patients now. And the answer is call your employer, call your insurer, and as you said, how many of us, including myself, have been in that, you know, first appeal, second appeal, third appeal. Maybe it will work, maybe it won't. Maybe you know what buzzwords to use in your letter. Maybe your doctor will help you. Maybe your employer will help you. But it shouldn't be a kind of desperate last-ditch runaround that takes hours of your time.
Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, and we are talking about problems in healthcare these days. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopin, and we've obviously touched a nerve because a number of people have called in to talk about their experiences in this area. Mike from Jersey City, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm calling in because I had kind of an unusual situation with Obamacare that I haven't heard anyone else talk about before. I signed up for Obamacare beginning of last year when I was unemployed, and then I, after that, got a contract assignment from a contracting firm that did not offer health care, so I continued to pay premiums into the Obamacare plan, and I was very happy with that. And then midway through the year, my contracting company began to offer their own health care. So I no longer qualified for Obamacare, and I had to switch to a new provider and pay all my premiums and deductibles all over again to a new provider. So all those doctor's bills that I paid with the expectation that eventually mm-hmm. I would not have to continue paying, I had to start that process all over again. And then toward the end of the year, my contract was terminated, so I had no coverage. So I had to pay all the premiums and fees to two different plans, and then on top of that, pay a penalty for not having coverage at the end of the year.
Now, Elizabeth, this wow. sounds like the kind of glitches that nobody could have predicted, but seem like they probably occur quite often.
Yes, and I think, you know, we once a new system is in place, like the ACA and Obamacare, you see where the holes are, and there are certainly, you can say that the structure is a good one, but now we're discovering the holes, and those need to be plugged. And I think one of the issues is, as this caller was saying, you know, you change plans during the middle of the year, and your deductibles reset. You know, I've heard from plenty of people who had a baby, for example, in December, right? And they paid out their deductible, but then the baby's in the hospital January 1st, and the deductible resets, and suddenly they have huge out-of-pocket expenses. So there's certainly patient protections that need to be built into this system, and unfortunately, we discover them as patients, so to speak, fall through those holes.
And I've heard of pregnancy being described as a pre-existing condition.
Yes, that used to be a much bigger problem. It used to be that insurers could not offer pregnancy coverage, and if people wanted to get covered and were pregnant, it would be considered a pre-existing condition. So I think the pregnancy coverage overall has gotten much better in the ACA. There aren't those exceptions anymore.
Zoe from the Bronx, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm concerned about the administration of Medicare reimbursement. Like, if I get ordinary blood tests, a set of them through my doctor, the bill is like over $1,000, but Medicare only reimburses them for maybe $250, something like that. But when my friend went to the ER and had blood tests, Medicare reimbursed the hospital the full amount that they were charging, you know. And I don't know if they're... Are they trying to support the hospitals in some way, or do you know why that would be?
Well, there are different payments for there are different payment systems for inpatient and outpatient care, and the kinds of numbers you're talking about are obviously really high numbers for blood tests. Blood testing has become a kind of profit center for both inpatient and outpatient care generally. I mean, we're always struck by, if we have insurance, you look at the billed amount, and then it will say the paid amount is often a small fraction, maybe 10%. And, you know, the problem is, of course, if you're not insured, or even worse, if you're still in that, have one of those high deductible plans, your plan may have paid $250, but if you were in a high deductible plan, you could be stuck with that full amount, which is really pretty unbearable for a bunch of blood tests, even if you have a decent income. But so, yes, Medicare does pay differently for inpatient and outpatient care, and the idea was to help support the overhead of hospitals, which, of course, is higher. But there's a lot of question at this point about whether for something like a blood test you want to pay four times the amount you would pay for an outpatient blood test.
Are we seeing any interesting legislation going through Congress? You mentioned surprise medical bills.
Well, this is all at the state level. I think through Congress, you know, we'll see what happens after the presidential election is resolved and there's a new Congress. But there are a number of things going on at the state level. The surprise medical bill law, the original one, was in New York State, I'm proud to say, and it does offer some protection for New York State residents from surprise out-of-network billing. So I think that's important. A number of states are starting to replicate that law or do their own version of the law. So you're protected to some degree from, you know, the out-of-network anesthesiologist coming in on your procedure and saying, guess what, that's $5,000, even though you went to an in-network hospital, or the one we wrote about when I was at the Times about you go to an emergency room that's in-network, but the emergency room doctor is out-of-network, which is particularly kind of makes no sense to patients or logically. So in New York State, you can contest those bills. There's a form you can download from the internet which you send to your insurer and the provider and say this was a surprise out-of-network charge, and they should deal with it, and you should be protected. You shouldn't have to pay anything for that.
Richard from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just reading in the Bergen Record today about the difference, because the Republicans have been talking or making roadblocks and making it more difficult, and it's saying that they took steps over the last several years to undermine the 2010 law and fuel the current turmoil. Those decisions left the marketplace with many red states with poorer, sicker customers than otherwise might have had. In 8 of the 9 states where consumers' choices were most limited in 2017 had rejected Medicaid expansion and taken other steps that have weakened their marketplaces, data show. Can your guests comment on that, please?
Elizabeth.
Yes. You know, the dialogue from the start was, are you pro-ACA or anti-ACA? And many states chose not to expand Medicaid. And, of course, that's why I say healthcare is essentially local and states have huge control over what happens in their states. So, yes, if you were in a state that chose not to expand Medicaid, that puts a greater stress on the system overall, and that was a choice. I think you have to look locally at why we say the ACA isn't working, in what way isn't it working. Another example of that, of course, is we've heard a lot about the cooperative insurers failing, some of them in many states. Again, the ACA, the Congress didn't really support them to the full extent they were supposed to. So can we say the ACA is at fault? Not really. It's the backup support that the ACA needed in order to be fully effective, and it hasn't gotten that in a number of states and in a number of quarters in Congress.
In just a few moments we have left, your most recent piece in the New York Times was about the EpiPen price increase, which seems to be emblematic of a bigger problem. But what about the EpiPen? How did the auto-injector device is patented. So is this the only company that can make and sell it?
Well, the EpiPen story is pretty complicated. The epinephrine is obviously as old as the hills. There's nothing new in that.
And how were people taking it before the EpiPen came along?
Well, before there were auto injectors, a nurse would draw a little bit up into a syringe and give it to a person having an allergic reaction, or as when I was a little kid, a bad asthma attack. Then the auto injectors came around in the 80s, and they were really important because it meant that you didn't have to wait to get to a doctor if you knew you were prone to these anaphylactic reactions. But they were cheap. And they become progressively more expensive. And what happens is companies now patent the device. And the device is very hard to copy exactly to meet generic standards. So I think what happened basically is that over time, one company more or less had cornered the market for those auto injectors. And what do you do if you're a company, a for-profit company, and you corner a market? You raise prices, and until there's pushback and until there's a way to correct that, either through generics or some kind of march-in rights where we're allowed to bring in EpiPens from overseas where they're cheaper, that's going to change. I mean, there are a lot of solutions, but none of them are really practical right now. And so now the solution we have is shaming, right? Which is what we saw with the EpiPen thing in the last few weeks. Someone notices that it's suddenly $600 for an EpiPen. And guess what? Kids who have really severe allergic reactions may want one kit for school, one kit for their after-school soccer program, another kit for camp in the summer. And it gets really expensive. And so someone gets outraged. And then there are hearings and there are a lot of news stories. And then everything settles back into the same old, same old. You know, of course, the company that makes the EpiPen, Mylan, has now offered rebates and it's offered to make a cheaper generic, but that's a really one-off solution for EpiPens. And there are a lot of drugs that are quietly undergoing the same inflationary pricing that the EpiPen was.
And we're talking about $600 for a drug that costs $1 a dose.
Right.
We mentioned that your book will be coming out in the next spring.
Next April.
An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How to Take It Back. We have a link to the on our show page to pre-ordering it. That's WNYC.org/Lopate. And Elizabeth, it's always a pleasure having you on our show. Thank you so much for being with us again today.
Thank you, and I'm sure I hope there'll be a next time.
Good. Of course there will be. Elizabeth Rosenthal, who is now the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News.